joint meeting of Environment and Natural Resources Finance Committee and Jobs and Economic Development Finance Committee, and Chairman Osment said, "You're junior, you have to chair the meeting." So we're starting. I know we don't have a lot of people here yet, and we normally start in my committee at 20 after. About right, isn't it?
No, sir, you start right on time at 8:15 every day.
Well, I give you a little time. But,
I heard it.
But anyway, so we'll call this meeting to order. I don't think we have a quorum, but it's a joint hearing. And first of all, we have Terry Coleman from the Public Facilities Administration. Are you up first?
Mr. Chair, yes. Don't mind, we've got kind of a plan program for you, and I'll briefly lay it out.
You think, I don't know, people from your committee come over? We don't have a quorum for mine. You want to wait a while?
No, it's okay. We can go ahead.
Okay, go ahead. Welcome to the committee again.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, my name is Terry Coleman. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority. Sitting to my left is Lisa Tharvig, Assistant Commissioner of Pollution Control Agency. I do plan on providing an overview of the Public Facilities Authority, but then we'll pretty much concentrate on the clean water-related programs, wastewater programs. And Lisa's here to try to explain the relationship between the two agencies. They do all the technical aspects. We tend to do the financing. We also provide lots of funds for non-point source pollution programs, and I want the committee members to get a brief overview of those programs. So Faye Sleeper from PCA and Paul Burns from Department of Ag will be presenting a briefly summary of those programs and what they do. And then Mark Schmidt from Pollution Control Agency and Jeff Freeman from my staff will present some issues related to wastewater and the priority system that they've been working on the last year, and hopefully next year, year and a half, some revised priority system rules will be adopted. And just kind of want to go over some of the highlights and points of that, because it'll have a fairly significant impact on how priorities for expenditures of funds will occur in the future. And then Jeff will also present the WIF report, which I think tends to be a very popular program with the legislature, and that will kind of lead in. And the governor recommended $10 million for that program in the bonding bill this year, and that is the most any governor has ever approved for that program, so we're quite pleased. So that's kind of the batting order, and feel free to interrupt us with questions at any time, and we'll gladly respond to them. If they're tough questions, I'll ask for help. If they're softball ones, I'll gladly answer. And with that, I will start. The Minnesota Public Facilities Authority is a fairly unique entity in state government. It actually is an interagency agency consisting of six different state agencies. You'll see the members there are commissioners or their delegates from six agencies: Department of Trade or Economic Development, Employment and Economic Development. It's going to take a while for me to get used to that. Matt Kramer is the chair of the Public Facility Authority, and the chair is responsible for providing the staff to support the activities of the authority. So the employees of the PFA literally are indeed employees. Commissioner of Finance, Pollution Control Agency, Health, Agriculture, and Transportation. So there's six members on that board, all of which have ties to various programs we operate. The Minnesota Public Facilities Authority main expertise, I think, we bring to the table, we provide municipal finance expertise. We manage three revolving loan funds, one grant or supplemental loan program, the WIF program. Currently, we have $1 billion in revenue bonding authority, which we issue revenue bonds. In essence, we pool local government issues into a single issue, provide low-interest loans with the funds we get from the legislature and federal government. With those bonds, And we also fund several state agencies. The non-point source programs we'll talk about, the money comes out of the Clean Water Fund for those. We also provide administrative costs to manage the programs. PCA's cost for reviewing plans and specs and certifying projects to us. We try to cover that cost. The Department of Health has several mandates they have to deal with under the Safe Drinking Water Act. And we'll get into that a little more. So we cover those costs, or most of them anyway. And currently the total assets of the authority, a little in excess of $1.5 billion. And a lot of that is in loans payable, the loans we've made, but also a lot of it is the equity we get from the state and the federal grants for the revolving loan funds. Real quickly, the PFA programs, technically it's called the Water Pollution Control Revolving Fund in this, Chapter 446A. It's often referred to as Clean Water, SRF, because we deal with a lot of clean water issues with that program. The Wastewater Infrastructure Funding Program, or WIF, you probably hear that a lot. And if you've been around a long time, it tends to be a fairly popular program in the arena of wastewater during the bonding session. And that is a program that supplements loans made through Water Pollution Control Revolving Fund to buy down the costs and make systems affordable in their high cost in small communities. And we also match USDA Rural Development, which is a federal agency that provides loans and grants for wastewater projects to get them to be able to fully utilize their funding. Without that match, a lot of their loan funds tend to go back to Washington because they don't have the number of projects to do loans only, but their grant dollars are in great demand. The Drinking Water Revolving Loan Fund, we work with in partnership with the Department of Health and primarily make loans to small communities, although I shouldn't say primarily. Minneapolis is our biggest borrower, but projects are ranked based on health-related issues with drinking water systems, and we fund them in fairly entirely order when they're ready to proceed. The Transportation Revolving Loan Program has been fairly stagnant in the last couple of years. The legislature tapped $8 million out of that fund to balance the budget last session, so we really didn't have any money to make loans with last year. But that is a program that's provided some seed money through the Federal Highway Administration, through what's called the State Infrastructure Bank. They wanted states to look at creative ways to look at leveraging additional dollars other than federal dollars, and a lot of the states have gas tax to do transportation projects, and we have done that fairly successfully with this little bit of money we have received. And again, using our revenue bonds to leverage those funds. The new Federal Highway Transportation Act looks like they will again authorize funding for the SIBs, and will leave it up to the state transportation commissioners to allocate, I think, up to a certain percent of the total allocation for that program. Otherwise, it's been locked up in Congress the last several years over Davis-Bacon wage rates, and whether they should apply to every project that's funded through the program or just the first round. A lot of, at least southern states, have been trying to get Davis-Bacon off the books after the first round of loans. In Minnesota's case, we have our own state wage rates, so we don't care, we just want the money. The water programs, which probably concentrate on these most, clean water and drinking water funds are very similar. We provide low-interest loans to municipalities for projects that either protect the environment or public health. Project priorities are set by a pollution control agency when it comes to wastewater and the Department of Health when it comes to drinking water. Funds are capitalized with federal grants and state match. We do have a bonding request we'll mention later in the slide presentation for $16.2 million to match the federal money. And that match is a $1 state match to $5 of federal. The funds are self-supporting with the federal dollars. I think we're allowed to take up to 4% of the grants each year for administrative costs. And the legislature also has authorized us to take fees from the loan repayments to help support the costs. And they are self-supporting. We did not use any general fund money to cover the cost of the programs. And we try to cover the costs related to the other agencies' activities as well. The wastewater infrastructure funding program is really a gap financing tool. We look at setting standards for at least minimum base debt service operation maintenance costs before the state steps in. Rural development, which is a federal agency, when we match their grants, they have had a standard of about 1.7% of the median household income should go towards water user fees or wastewater user fees before they kick in grant subsidies. And we match their grant 50-50. So if they assume the city can take out a $500,000 loan on $1 million project, they'll put in $250,000 grant, and we'll put in $250,000 grant. And we've been very successful in getting them to use the state's priority list generated by PCA when the legislature allowed us to match the grants here. And we've also worked out interagency cooperation, so we eliminate the duplication. I don't know if most people are aware, but when there's multiple agencies, especially federal and state agencies, funding projects, there's a lot of duplication. Every agency wants an environmental review done according to their environmental review laws, and everybody has to do a certain amount of plans and spec approval. We've worked all that out to eliminate the duplication. We decide up front when the projects are ranked whether it's going to trigger an EAW. If it does, PCA does the environmental review. If it doesn't, USDA does and saves the state the administrative costs of doing that. The clean water program. We've made 260 wastewater loans to date for $1.3 billion. The interest savings, which is how we measure our success to date, if cities were to go to the private market and borrow the funds at market rate, we save them over $377 million. And we calculate that fairly conservatively. We assume every city in the state could sell AAA-rated GO bond debt. We use the AAA-rated GO scale when we calculate what cities could sell bonds for when we calculate interest savings. We also provide up to 18 months on wastewater and 6 months on drinking water interest-free period for them while they're under construction, so there's no cost of money while they draw down and pay their bills. We've also provided over $71 million for non-point source programs. The only agency I won't talk much about is DEED. We've provided Department of Trade and Economic Development, when it was called that, $2 million. Half of that went to the Small Cities Development Program run by Louis Jamboy, and they used that loan supplement with their federal CDBG grant money and did septics in rural communities rather than having the small towns go into some a wastewater treatment system when septic upgrades would work. They tried that a year or two later. I think the legislature funded the Department of Ag to do the same thing, so we pretty much left that up to the Department of Agriculture on septics. We've also funded the tourism loan program. So any water-based business, hotels, resorts, on water, they have septic upgrades. We provided them money, and they've lent out over $750,000 in the repayments that are coming in seem to be adequate to address the ongoing demand for upgrading that. So it's worked real well trying to keep the small resorts around the state open. The wastewater needs. 2004 project priority list, there was over 222 projects totaling $1.5 billion. That's a lot. The intended use plan, and that's how far down that priority list we're willing to go based on projects that are ready to proceed or say they're going to proceed. We've authorized 69 different projects that said they were ready to go. with a total request of about $255 million. We assume that only about half of those will go, because a lot of projects that get delayed in the environmental review or the what I hate to see, but happens a lot, is the engineers tend to lowball these costs until they get right up to the point where the final plans and specs are done, and all of a sudden the costs double, and then the city's...
Mr. Coleman, Representative Mahoney has a question.
Take a few months to think about it. Yes.
I'm looking at your priority list, 222 projects. That's for this year, or is that for biennium?
That's total.
That's the total needs out there that PCA has on their list today. Cities that have said they've got wastewater problems or PCA enforcement staff have identified as having problems with their wastewater.
And you have funding to get up to 69 of the highest priority projects?
Correct.
And so in this biennium, you say, here's your all 69, here's the funding for it. Then all of a sudden you've got whatever the math is, and I'm not going to try and do it on the fly. Does everyone automatically move up one, or do you reprioritize the next year or the next biennium?
That list gets reprioritized every time a new project submits a letter to PCA and saying, we've got a problem with this. That project, you know, eventually gets ranked when the facility plan is reviewed, so that the priority list changes. We take their list every year at the beginning of the fiscal year and say, this is the priority list for this coming year, and we work and develop what's called the intended use plan. We look at all the projects on the priority list, ask all the cities that want to proceed with their project to let us know. We look at how many projects that is, and then we go down and see how far we feel comfortable in funding. Because we do try to balance the assets of the authority, so we have some capacity over the long term to continue to fund high priority projects.
Representative Mahoney.
Is that a pretty stable list once you come up here and get your funding? Is that fairly stable for that 12 or 24 month period? And my question trying to get to is, I think we had quite the argument in jobs last year, the year before, about someone trying to move their project up on that particular list.
Yeah. So,
Mr. Coleman.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, with the WIF program, which is the grant for the supplemental assistance, we lock the projects in the day the bill is signed into law. And so that list that you'll see later in your book is the priority list we're going to go with. We're not changing those priorities at all. I mean, the legislature has a prerogative, you know, to fund whatever they want and have done in the past to some extent. But as a general rule, they tend to follow that list and fund the projects. Now, the loan list is good for a fiscal year. Next fiscal year, my guess is, based on history, there'll be another 20 or 30 projects added to that list, and they'll be scattered throughout the priority list. There might be 10 that will jump into the top, you know, 60, 70 projects. So.
Representative Doran, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. Mr. Coleman, go ahead.
And again, we estimate receiving about $24.7 million from the federal government each year. That's we're requesting the 20% match for those. And that's really where we get the equity. And when the federal government gives us a lot of money, which they have, and the state matches that, and we throw that into the loan pool, that allows us to buy down the interest rates or provide low interest loans to the community. So we leverage substantially. Give you an idea of the leverage goes, just look at the sources of funds in it. The federal government, for all the loans we've made or uses, the federal government has provided about 24% of the funds. The state has provided 5% of the total funds. This program's fairly mature. It's been around. We made our first loan in 1989, June of 89. So as those loans recycle, we've had a substantial amount of revenue. That's 17% and PFA revenue bonds is about 53%. So over half of the funds are from the issuing revenue bonds. And in the book, you'll find a lot more detail, including breakdowns of subrecipients for the non-point programs, as well as administrative dollars we provided each agency. And I do want to mention on the administrative dollars in your book, those are cumulative since back in 1989. The totals there for this year, the board has approved $456 million for DTED out of this fund, and $1,000,001 for PCA, which is about $200,000 more than we've provided in the past, but we've been trying to address some of the priority project issues, as well as a little more coordination with the engineering area and the funding sources. So, drinking water program, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the drinking water program, but we have made 132 loans for $219 million, total interest savings $55 million. The current project priority list, there's 268 different projects on the list totaling $322 million. The intended use plan for this year, we've gone down to the about two-thirds. I won't even say that. About two-thirds of the requests we got in for the funding this year, we've said could submit for $115 million. We anticipate close to $16 million from the federal government for this program. Breakdown in sources and uses, real quick, the federal funds make up 42%. Net revenue is only 6%. The state funds are 9%. And again, revenue bonds account for 43% of the funds, so big chunk of the money going into it. And I forgot to mention uses as well, but obviously the vast majority of the money goes to loans, and I think the next biggest chunk really goes to sub-grants, which deal with operator certification training, source water protection, and various other mandates under the Clean Water Program to make sure municipalities have well-trained staff to operate drinking water systems and that they're aquifers are being protected. And administration is 2% of the total. A little summary of the loan summary. I think we made the first loan. I should mention the first loan was made to St. James on the wastewater project in June of 1989. We were the fifth state to use to make a loan, and the first loan made out of that program under the federal program was in May, so we were only a month behind. And the state of Minnesota was the first to issue revenue bonds to leverage those funds. So that was pretty neat. We were also one of the, I think, first three states to make drinking water loans, so we've been fairly rapid in getting these programs up and running and working. And first drinking water loan was made to the city of Folden in southwest Minnesota as well. The wastewater infrastructure funding program, this is what seems to get about 90% of the discussion up at the legislature because it really is a gap financing tool or grant. And cities really like to do it. But it's primarily designed to keep systems affordable. The smaller communities, the scale of economy for wastewater systems tends to be a little out of proportion. So they tend to be fairly high cost, and we try to look at this program to get those high priority projects funded and still affordable, not cheap by any means. We have user rates anywhere from $50 to $100 a month after the grants are done. So if you go home and look at your water and sewer bill and see if you're paying that, you're probably not, unless you have a couple teenage girls like I had that have since moved out. You get close. But the program, most of the projects we've done the last couple of years since we've developed this partnership with USDA to match their grants, and that has worked out real well. and it really reduces a lot of the administrative costs dealing with small rural communities, because they have lots of field staff that are there, and they do the oversight and the construction review and approve the billings and stuff, so it makes our life real easy in making payments. And helps PCA out a lot, too, as far as the internal reviews that they have to go through. For the non-rural development projects, we changed the legislation a couple years ago. We no longer provide grants, but we provide 0% loans with the first payment beginning after the water, Clean Water Revolving Loan Fund is paid off. So year 21, they start paying that loan off. And we calculate that based on 5% of market value. And the reason we went with market value is we were seeing a lot of projects on lakeshore property, and the value of those properties has skyrocketed in the last 5-6 years. And even before that, when we were doing them, we'd find that the market value, once sewer was installed on some of these lakes, market value of the properties that were getting sewered were increasing by 40% or so. So we figured it better to try to tie it into the market value. It still has advantages for the small rural communities where the value isn't very, very strong, and the allows properties that have pretty significant value to use some of the assets that were helped establish pay off that loan. So it's worked out fairly well.
Representative Mahoney has a question.
On your market value, your 5% of market value, I believe we at the legislature in the last few years pretty much eliminated market value, limited market value. Is that the same principle you're using here? That is something that we eliminated a couple, 3 years ago?
Mr. Coleman.
Well, you didn't really eliminate it, because the Department of Revenue still gathers all that information for the basis of the local property taxes, the what is the market value, and they adjust for, and I forget, Jeff Freeman could probably explain it because he's worked with the Department of Revenue when we set this up, but they adjust it to try to reflect the true, you know, value of the property in that whatever jurisdiction. And they break down all the taxing jurisdictions separately. So if there's a sanitary sewer district that takes in portions of like three townships, I mean, that will show up separately and on their stuff. And we do ask the local participants when they're requesting funds to provide us that information if they want with. But that is information that's collected, and it's still the basis of the property tax system is the market value, even though the calculations are different, or tax capacity issues.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, well, and I'm not a tax guy. I grant that without any question, or property tax. Hard for me to understand all of that. Too many numbers.
Me too.
But I believe we eliminated the limited market value on property taxes for cities, states, and everyone else. And what I'm seeing here is that you decided that it was a good idea to keep. And your loan repayment is based on a limited market value rate. Am I kind of close to that? Am I getting this right?
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Representative Mahoney, yes. I mean, we look at when you're going from an unsewered community, which most of the WIF projects are, to a sewer community, that adding sewer has a significant impact on the property values. I mean, they tend to go up. And we thought it was logical to tie any kind of grant funding to that that type of formula. And that and the data was readily available. It's easy to obtain. We're like income, median household income. I mean, it's the only information is updated every 10 years, so it gets way out of date where property value is updated annually.
Well, the market value and limited market value data is pretty readily available in my particular district, and there's not a lot of happy people there after what they're seeing. So I wonder, does Representative, the chairman of the tax committee understand that that's your after hearing him on the House floor, he seemed pretty adamant of the fact that that was not a good idea. I'm just wondering if the tax chair has any idea that you're still using something that he thinks is probably the dumbest idea we ever had.
Not that I'm aware of.
Oh, thank you.
To that point, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dolman.
Mr. Chair, let me phrase this a little bit differently and see if I understand it. I think what you're saying is the value goes up, the property owner pays more. Is that correct? Or do you shield the property owner?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. What it was meant to address, to be real honest, is we had a lot of lakeshore properties that were coming in and qualifying for huge state grant subsidies. And we also had, you know, a lot of real small communities that never got the federal grants or state grants back in the grant days that still hadn't had wastewater systems. What we're trying to do is make it a little more equitable. You know, when you have cities like East Gull Lake, which under the old system probably would have qualified for like a 50% grant because of a very high cost installing that sewer system, and you have property values ranging from individual homeowners' homes in the $1 million to $5 million range, it was really hard, and we got a lot of grief showing that on our WIF list, projects like that coming to request WIF money. So looking at it, how do you try to generate a system that's statewide? We looked at, you know, what's the impact when we tie it to market value of the property that's benefiting from the sewer system, and it seems to work by eliminating or reducing a lot of the grant subsidies that go into Lakeshore. Not all, but because Lakeshore property values vary drastically around the state. There's some very, very expensive Lakeshore properties, and there's some that aren't there yet. So it works.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, that actually works then, I think, well with the limited market value that Chairman Abrams and others have tried to get rid of, because limited market value would shield those high-valued homes and shift those property taxes into low-valued homes. So I think if I understand what he's saying is he's trying to get the cost based on the increased market value. So that actually works opposite of how the limited market value works. In the case of a limited market value, take the same homes on Gull Lake that have jumped up, limited market value would protect those homeowners from those property tax costs, but somebody's got to pay them. Those would be shifted onto lower value property that didn't increase in value. And so if I understand him correctly, what they're saying is they want to get those costs on those high value homes and not protect them. The limited market value program protected those homes, so I don't see them as in opposition.
Okay. Chair Osmond.
I think he explained it better than I did.
the way I'm reading this, it also is providing for the amount of money that would be available for the project. So the way you're calculating it actually provides for more money to be available for the particular project, or am I reading something wrong here?
We look at the total cost, and we subtract out from our grant calculation amounts that are designed for growth. So, you know, if there's like a 25% capacity, you know, we look at the total cost and kind of knock off 25% off that total cost. So we just deal with the existing problems. We try to provide 100% of the funding, you know, through whether or not just WIF, but we'll use all the grant programs available if we can. So 100% of the project is covered regardless. But what we try to do is keep the loans affordable. So, you know, we don't like seeing residential property owners paying $100 a month. That's steep. But sometimes it just can't be helped. And the few that we do have, the cities have no problem with $100 a month. You know, looking at the alternatives and the public hearings they had, that people were willing to do it. But.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have a generalized idea of what the special assessments, when we're running right now $50 to $100 on the monthly fee, what kind of additional special assessments are happening out in the in the communities, and my community was about $6,500 per hookup. And is there any horizon that we might be helping to finance that part of the thing, or are we going to just leave that on the taxes and let the county collect the interest? And how's that all? How's that all? I ask about three questions, I know. But.
Okay.
Mr. Coleman.
When we don't provide WIF, I'd say the average assessment, and whether it's an assessment or mill levy or people just raise their rates, but the average cost, somewhere between $5,000 and $7,500 per house when we go in with a fairly major system. If it's a brand new system, we see those costs anywhere from $15,000 to $30,000 per house. So it does vary across the board. And also a lot depends on what else they do. We don't calculate, you know, restoration costs if they're going digging up an old gravel road and putting in a 10-ton blacktop with curb and gutter and storm sewer. We take that cost out, but you know, a lot of communities will do upgrades that we won't finance at the same time. So that, from the homeowner's perspective, they might be paying a lot more than. But 65 is pretty reasonable if you had any WIF assistance in with it. Is that?
You know what, Mr. Chairman? What about financing the back end of that then? Is there any reason why we want to look at helping to finance the special assessments? Rather, you know, right now, basically the options are the resident or business pays. Finds their own financing or puts it on their property taxes for eons.
Right. Our WIF program, when we look at it, is really trying to write down that cost. I mean, if the local jurisdiction is assessing the cost, and one of our biggest complaints, and we do give local units of government grief on this, is a lot of times we'll make a loan at 1%, 1.5%. And they'll turn around and do special assessments and tack on 7-8%. And, you know, we raise red flags and say, hey, you know, there's a lot of issues that get involved in that. There's no state law that limits how much interest local jurisdictions can cost. But we're very concerned about arbitrage issues and a whole lot of other things. So we try to get them to limit to no more than 1 or 2% over and above our interest rate when they calculate an interest on a special assessment. When they use it through user fees and stuff like that, you don't see that cost being built in.
Thank you.
But that's the best I can answer. We try
Representative Kahn, I believe you have a question.
Wait, can we finish this?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, and I guess I should know this, and I apologize if it was answered earlier. How is the WIF fund filled? Is it a through bonding or through appropriations?
WIF fund is through bonding. We have the largest bonding proposal we've ever had, I believe, is what you said, at $10 million.
How much did you say?
$10 million. It leverages, the WIF funds through our bonding bill leverage how much with the feds?
It's a 50-50 match with rural development, so okay. For those projects. And most of the projects you'll see later on the list are rural development matches. I think the last year when the legislature appropriated $15 million to WIF, that took a lot of the projects that were non-rural development. We had a couple big ones, Mille Lacs Lake and Lake Chetek down in Murray County, that took like $4 million, $4.5 million each. And those were not rural development match, but so the big ones are off the table for this year. So.
Okay. Representative Agenius has got a question.
Okay.
Thank you, and I don't want to jump the gun, Mr. Chairman, but what I'm missing here is even if we put this much money on the table this year. Relative to the need, how many years, and you may be addressing this later, so if you are, I'll let it go, but how many years is it going to take to deal with all the requests for wastewater treatment systems on one hand, and then clean water on the other, drinking water on the other. Yeah.
Mr. Coleman.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius. Unfortunately, wastewater systems wear out, and if you look at their useful life of a treatment plant of about 25 years and collection in the neighborhood of 50 to 100 years, and I'll say the state, I'm not saying the state of Minnesota, but the state as a whole, the communities and everything, and you look at the total investments being made annually, not only from us, but, you know, developer finance, local government finance, and other funding programs, the investment just not there if you looked at appreciation of the assets. So we're losing ground. And another concern we have, and we'll probably talk about it later when we get into the rural project priority system, is there's a lot of the systems that exist today were built, you know, years and years ago, and the different technologies that were used at those times have changed. When at the turn of the century, when they were building stuff, they were building things with a 100-year design life. And then in the 20s and 30s, they started building stuff with an 80-year design life. You know, when the federal government got involved in the 30s and more rapidly got involved in the 60s with funding wastewater, they started designing things with a 25-year life.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have is all this investment over the last 100 years that's starting to age to the point. And infrastructure is one of those things that will work, you know, steadily for a long time, and then its decline will be very rapid. I mean, just in a few years. So we're waiting for that steep turn. We're doing our best to try to upgrade systems now to address that. But I don't think the state by itself, you know, can address the total need. It's really up to the local units of government to do that. We're there to help, but we're not the sole answer.
Representative Guineas.
Well, I wasn't implying necessarily that we were the sole answer,
mm-hmm.
but it is something that, I mean, the state is responsible for protecting our groundwater. So my question is, okay, you're saying at the rate we're going, we're falling behind. So then the question is, how would we get to neutral? What would it take to get to neutral? And then what would it take to have a projection where we could say, well, we will have taken care of this or be on a track that we are protecting our water? Those are two numbers we need. I don't know that you have them, but I think if you don't, I think they're important for us to have.
Yeah. We've done some of that work in the past. I haven't really looked at those issues, to be quite honest, for the last 3-4 years.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, when we looked at total investments that were made, we were probably pushing close to like $3.5 billion on wastewater. And if you did an averaged 40-year life expectancy, assuming treatment plants, you know, shorter, collection longer, you can work out the math. And if we're putting in, you know, the Public Facilities Authority last year, you know, we spent like almost $250 million, which was a very large year for us on infrastructure. You know, we made a good dent in that for 1 or 2 years, but the fund, you know, can't sustain that level of funding offhand. But I would say if we could get in that neighborhood of investment in public infrastructure, water, wastewater, we could probably make a dent and maintain and maybe upgrade a little.
And what was the
about a quarter of a billion a year?
A quarter of a billion a year.
Yeah.
And is that is between state and local?
Yeah. Federal, everybody.
Okay. And what would that, just for the state's part of that, what would it take to keep us on an even keel?
I think if the federal government doubled the amount of money they provide and the state matched accordingly, we could probably get there. I don't, you know, I see a lot of movement in Congress or a lot of discussion in the last 5-6 years, but no bills actually making it out of committee that would do that. But I think it's a national problem. It's not just Minnesota. I mean, we're in the boat with we're probably even a little ahead of the game compared to a lot of states. So it is a national problem, and it's something that being discussed a lot in Washington, but I haven't seen a lot of action.
Representative McGinnis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I mean, I think it's from a practical point of view, mm-hmm. we can't depend on Washington now because of the determination to shift more to defense and that's their determination, and I don't think that we have any place to argue that here. But I do think we have to look at it honestly and say we're not going to get the federal monies that we have in the past. And so what does that mean for us? Because, I mean, you're sitting next to the Pollution Control Agency with impaired waters cleaning up, costing us, just for a little piece of it, costing us $600 million to $3 billion just to clean up a tiny piece of our problem. So if we don't deal with the wastewater, we'll be on the continual treadmill of cleaning up, polluting, which is a very expensive way to go.
Yeah. I don't have a lot of answers for that, but I will mention one observation I've had since I've looked at this program, and I do think the state's been making progress. When the revolving loan fund program was created and the federal grants were, you know, ceased for construction of municipal wastewater, when you look at the municipal audit statewide, and you look at the utility funds or enterprise funds for wastewater, you know, total, looking at all political jurisdictions that the state auditor collected data on, and I guess all of them, there was a $6 billion deficit in the sewer funds statewide. And I stopped doing that analysis about 7 years ago, after about 10 years of the program being in existence, because that number is up to a close to $1 billion. I shouldn't say surplus funds, but no longer in the hole. It had at least $1 billion out there in their sewer and water funds. So they went kind of bridged like a $7 billion gap in about 10 years. You've also seen water and sewer rates go from $3 to $5 a month to what they are today, and most people are paying at least $25 and on up to, like I said, $100. So things are paying, I mean, moving, and I think that's what it takes is really, you know, bottom line, charge adequate user fees, and I think municipalities have done a fairly good job improving their position over time. That's the best I can respond right now.
Representative Guineas.
I can understand that that's the best you can respond sitting up here, but I do think that we need to have kind of a picture that we can look up on one page and say, this is the size of the problem. Let's not make the assumptions that the feds come in and bail, you know, have with lots of money. What is it we have to do year by year to at least reach an equilibrium and not fall behind? And what if we wanted to get ahead so we wouldn't have this other cleanup problem that we're sitting here facing? So it would be helpful to have those numbers to look at. It's hard to make judgments without a context.
Mr. Chair.
Very good questions. I've always wondered what would happen if we invest $10 million more. Will we get federal match for $10 million more? Where's the end of it? There's always been a list as long as I've been here. We've always attempted to uphold the integrity of that list. So with that, I know we got quite a ways to go before our committee time's over with, so maybe if we could hold our questions, maybe they would be answered in the rest of the testimony. Go ahead.
All right. Good lead into my capital budget request. Sure. We're asking for $16.2 million or $280,000 to match the federal EPA money, and that's the what we totally expect to be our allotment for allocation from EPA in the next two fiscal years. And again, I just wanted to point out, you know, for every dollar we get in state match, we've done $12 in construction, so that's a very good leverage. And one of the analyses they don't do anymore, but if you just looked at the sales tax being collected on the equipment purchases or material purchases on that type of leverage, and then you take into account income tax on employees, they're getting fairly good wages doing this type of work, and the corporate income tax is paid by the contractors. A lot of, they'll tell you they've never made any money, all their profits go to fees and permits, but it generally pays for itself. It's so it's a good investment for the state to make. Plus, we're saving, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in user fees through low-interest loans. Now, the WIF program, the governor's in for $10 million. I mean, that will address pretty much the top 50 or projects in need of WIF assistance in the top 50 of the needs list. $200,000 is generally for administrative costs, because this is over and above what we do with the clean water, and it does generate a lot of excess work for the pollution control agency engineers that have to review facility plans and specs to get these things going, as well as the coordination with PCA for rural development. And real briefly, PFA revenue bonding, where we have a bill that should be introduced shortly to address some of our revenue bonding issues. But I do want to mention real quickly, our revenue bonds are AAA rated. We're separate from the state's bond rating. We had our AAA rating before the state of Minnesota got theirs. To be quite honest, we were the first pooled program in the nation to get a rating higher than a AA. That was back in 1995. We got a AA plus, and it's fairly significant moved by the rating agencies. They kind of shifted their approach from looking at individual loans and these revolving loan funds at a national level, and comparing them with individual homeowner loans through state housing agency bonds. When they started making the shift, realizing these were general obligation debts of municipalities, and most states had some kind of safety net, so the high cost projects in low-income, least credit-worthy communities had some kind of financing to help them make those systems affordable. They started looking more favorably, and you started seeing a rash of AAA-rated state revolving loan funds related to municipal water and wastewater. But we did break that mold, and we're kind of proud of that. And again, there's no backing on the state, on the PFA bonds whatsoever. They're standalone, bold print on our OS or official statements, the offering circular when we sell bonds. We have no taxing authority, and the state is has no liability in, to make up for any defaults or anything like that. Our legislative proposals, we have really one bill to increase our bonding authority from $1 billion to $1.25 billion, and that really should keep us going for another 2, possibly 3 years. We've been averaging $50 million a year on drinking water the last couple of years, and close to $100 million a year on wastewater. This year we didn't sell wastewater bonds. We offered, the market rates were so low this summer. We allowed a lot of the municipalities that borrowed money from us earlier that had fairly high interest rates and short terms left on their loans to refinance. So we got $146 million in on early prepayments. So that kind of helped us get by without selling bonds for the clean water program. The second one is also this summer, when rates were real low, there was a proposal that PFA looked at to do some refunding of our bonds. We looked at it real seriously. You know, we couldn't do an advance refunding because of the amount of, or the yield on the investments from the bond proceeds until the call date on those bonds was so low that we would have been losing money. There's another technique in the municipal marketplace that where they use an option to sell bonds. So you go to the market today and sell an option to sell those bonds in 3 to 5 years, and they pay you cash up front. And we looked at that this summer and thought we could generate about $10 million refinancing in 3 to 5 years, about $124 million worth of our outstanding bonds. And we simply couldn't do it. So we're, because our statute, when you're selling municipal bonds, you have to have real explicit, clear authority to do that. So we're trying to modernize our statutes a little bit to accommodate that. So there's some language. I think Representative Knobloch will be presenting that bill shortly. So not that we'll use it, but the market conditions were such this summer it would have been very attractive if we had that authority. With that, conclude my presentation. I'm more than willing to respond to any more questions. Otherwise, I'll ask a couple from Paul Burns and Faye Sleeper from, or at least I'll ask Lisa make a few comments first. I'm sorry. On kind of the role or relationship between the PFA and the PCA.
Welcome to committee. Please give your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Thorvig, Assistant Commissioner from the Pollution Control Agency. And I'm responsible for water policy at our agency, and I represent the Pollution Control Agency on the PFA board. Kind of a simple description of the relationship between PFA and the PCA is that PFA are the bankers and we're the engineers and scientists that deal with the wastewater and non-point source issues. For municipal wastewater projects, PCA is responsible for conducting the environmental review, engineering review, technical assistance, and environmental permitting. We also have rules that describe how projects are ranked and placed in priority order for funding, which gets to be a very important thing for a lot of communities and often very controversial. And each year we score these projects and provide PFA with a project priority list for use and funding. We're currently revising our rules on how projects are ranked because we want to address other environmental issues that weren't around when we upgraded the list about 10 years ago. Things like aging infrastructure that Terry referred to, and things like impaired waters, which we were talking about earlier this week to some of the environmental committees. We are going to have a presentation on those rule updates and how we're making changes later. That will come a little bit later. PFA provides funding support, as Terry said, for engineers and scientists related to the Clean Water State Revolving Fund. So we do get funding for that activity. This support does not extend to PCA staffing needs related to the wastewater infrastructure funds. So PCA needs a general fund appropriation equivalent to 2% of the amount that the governor recommends and the legislature appropriates in WIF. This year, the governor is recommending $10 million in WIF, so the PCA needs $200,000 in general fund appropriation. If we don't receive the general fund appropriation, then we actually become a bottleneck to the financing and the construction of projects because we won't have the resources to complete environmental assessment worksheets, conduct facility plan reviews, and actually issue the permits that are needed to construct these facilities in a timely manner. Besides the wastewater projects, the Clean Water Revolving Fund also supports PCA's Clean Water Partnership Program, which focuses on non-point source projects such as failing septic systems, feedlot fixes, and improvements in drainage and things to clean up our waters. Minnesota is actually a national leader in non-point source projects, and you're going to be hearing more in just a few minutes from Faye Sleeper on the Clean Water Partnership Program and Paul Burns on agriculture's ag BMP programs and how we use those funds to really protect our environment. I just want to conclude my comments by really thanking the legislature. because you guys have been great over the past several years in providing funds, the state revolving funds, the matching funds, so we can leverage all our federal money that we get in, and also the wastewater infrastructure. The legislature has been a huge supporter of getting funds into that program. And I want to praise Terry Coleman and the PFA staff, because although he mentioned a few times modestly about the leadership that PFA has provided, they do a great job across the nation in managing the funds for this state. And we have cleaner water and better and safer drinking water because of the great job they do in managing their funds and leveraging it and bringing more money in so we can do more than the small amount that we invest. So with that, I'll turn it over to Faye and Paul to talk about the non-point source programs.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Welcome to the committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Faye Sleeper. I'm a manager at the Pollution Control Agency with responsibility for the non-point source programs and the impaired waters program. Today, I'm going to give you a very brief overview of the Clean Water Partnership Program and highlight the portion funded through the State Revolving Fund. The Minnesota Legislature established the Clean Water Partnership Grant Program in 1987 to address surface and groundwater pollution from rural and urban non-point sources. The program leveraged and continues to leverage federal funds for non-point source pollution in accordance with Section 319 of the Clean Water Act. It leverages about $8 million of federal funds. The Clean Water Partnership Loan Program was established in 1995 using state revolving loan funds. The grant and loan programs are integrated into one process. The Clean Water Partnership takes a watershed-based approach in two phases. Phase one is a diagnostic phase to identify the water quality problems and sources that contribute to the problem. We have not funded phase one projects during the last three funding rounds for two reasons. One is this allows us to catch up. We had done quite a bit of assessment and we had a backlog of actual remediation work. And also we wanted to have the flexibility to target the money toward our impaired waters. Phase two is actually for project implementation and restoration on the ground work. In both phases of the Clean Water Partnership, local sponsors initiate proposed projects and submit applications to the MPCA to compete for the funds. In the grant request, we typically receive 3 to 4 times requests over the dollars that we have available. We then work with a team comprised of representatives from other state, local, and federal agencies to score and rank the projects. The loan program only funds activities in the restoration or phase two. It funds a variety of activities to address urban runoff, lakeshore degradation, agricultural runoff, and feedlot fixes, and upgrading substandard individual sewage treatment systems. This program has actually been a very important first step in addressing the impairments in Minnesota due to non-point sources. We estimate that 86 of our impairments are caused to non-point sources, and this is because of the great work in the point source arena in fixing those issues over the past decades. This program also protects those waters that are not yet impaired, so it is both a protection and a remediation program. This slide shows that we have dispersed $25.2 million in funds through the fiscal year 04 funding round. Actually, this does not include the $2 million that we have just received and are currently dispersing. You can see that the majority of the funds have been spent on the ground or in education, and education is a really important strategy for addressing non-point source pollution. Non-point source pollution often comes down to the individual homeowner, landowner. The top two practices funded by the Clean Water Partnership Loan Program are upgrades to individual sewage treatment systems and to feedlots. We have a much more detailed information on the Clean Water Partnership successes as well as federally funded non-point source in our annual report to EPA. It's titled Watershed Achievements, and we have copies that we would be happy to provide to you. Thank you for allowing me to talk briefly about the Clean Water Partnership. Now I'm going to turn it over to my colleague Paul Burns from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to discuss their Ag BMP program.
If I can find it.
Representative McGinnis.
While we're waiting for him to get the computer on, let me ask the question. You said you'd spent $25 million thus far for the implementation of the Phase 2 projects.
Mm-hmm.
What is the dollar amount outstanding for the rest of the Phase 2?
Yes, sir.
Representative Wagenius, Mr. Chair, I did not bring that number. I can get you that number. You're talking about those that have already completed a phase one?
Yes.
Yes, I will get that number for you. We estimate that the overall needs, if we were still doing diagnostics, is $600 million to $3 billion just for impairments, not for the protection.
Okay, but I think that it would be important for us just to understand what's in the pipeline
mm-hmm.
right now that we have essentially said to
right.
communities, make a proposal if you pass, and these, I know they work.
Mm-hmm.
The Clean Water Partnerships have an excellent reputation.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, are we fulfilling our side of the
mm-hmm.
obligation?
I don't know the exact number, and I will get that for you. I expect that we probably have 5 to 8 more years of backlog to fix.
And that is before we start again asking for people to make phase one proposals.
That's correct.
Mr. Burns, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Paul Burns with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And on your table in front of you, you should have a handout, a one-page handout that probably does a better job of explaining our Ag BMP loan program than I'll be able to do, given my speaking skills and also my ability to run the computer. But as Mr. Coleman mentioned, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture also has a non-point source low-interest loan program that has used state revolving funds and we think has used them to a very productive purpose. This is a flow chart of funding. In addition to, most of the money has come from the state revolving fund, but the legislature has also made a couple of one-time appropriations for specific purposes. One was for to supplement the funding for septic systems, and another one was to supplement funding for feedlot improvements. So the upper bar there shows the different sources of funding that can go into our system that are made available to the department. There was supposed to be a... there was supposed to be a fade-in that explains the structure of the program, but obviously it's not working. How it does work is we have two different mechanisms for how we've gotten the money out. In the first several years of the program, and this program was started in through some legislation in 1994. Our first loan was authorized, our first allocation to counties was authorized in 1996. And what we do is we make either allocations or loans to counties, and the purpose is to implement the agricultural portions of local water plans. So what in the beginning years of the program, we made an allocation to counties to, again, to implement the ag portions of their local water plan. They chose a local lending institution to handle the funds for them, and all the loans had to go through that institution. In 2001, we made some changes to the program. The original structure still remained. The counties could use that money for 20 years. After the 10th year, they'd begin to repay the state fund. In 2001, in response to some producers that didn't want to have to change their local bank, plus on fixes to property like feedlot upgrades, they're having some problems with the security setup between their home bank and the bank that the county was using. So in 2001, we started offering the opportunity to have any bank in the state participate, and we would revolve the loans at the state level. The county still directs which landowners get those funds. It's just that we opened it up to more banks and made it a lot more flexible. This is a listing of the appropriations made so far from the Public Facilities Authority and the State Revolving Fund. The $4 million in 1997 that was allocated to us to distribute through our system, specifically for septic systems. Now, originally, our program was set up, again, to mainly handle agricultural and other rural landowners. That $4 million was to go to fix any septic system anywhere in the county. And a few counties, about five counties, have chosen to under that funding, serve as the lender themselves and then collect the repayments on the property tax collection system. So the total of all appropriations is $49 million. This map shows an allocation across the state of where most of the money has gone. And this is a breakdown by type of project or type of practice that we've funded. As you can see, about a third of the funding has gone to a third of the projects, at least, has gone to septic systems, agricultural waste systems, or feedlot fixes, or manure land application equipment is another large type of practice that we finance. And through the $49 million and then the revolving nature of the program, we have now funded over $64 million in practices. And that's a very brief overview of how our system works.
Any other questions for these testifiers? Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Curious about repayment of those loans. How do you come out on those? Pretty good repayment. You'll lose a lot.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dorman. One of the nice features of having local banks handle the funds for us is that the local banks are required to guarantee the loan repayment back to the state. So we have a system for tracking the status, the stature of the banking, the lending institution. It's a survey that the Department of Commerce does every year, and if they fall below a certain standard, they have to put up hard security to guarantee the state loan. As far as the loans that the banks have made are two that have failed, and in most cases there are a couple other cases where the borrower has restructured the loan or made interest payments. So there's only one or two that we've heard of that the actual landowner has defaulted on the loan. And The repayments back to the state are now just starting to happen, and so far we've had no indication that there's any danger to the state funds.
Good, thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Would you please give your name for the record, and welcome to our committee, and Please bring it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jeff Freeman. I work for Terry Kuhlman with the Public Facilities Authority. And if you'll bear with us, we're going to shift gears back to wastewater projects now to conclude. In the booklets that you have, behind the first tab is our WIF report that we are required to prepare and submit to the legislature every other year. We just completed this report back in January, so the information is still very current. The first couple of pages give some background information on the report or on the WIF program. Page 2 summarizes the funds that the program has received to date and where those funds have gone. You'll notice in footnotes 1 and 2 toward the bottom half of the page, they're about $19.5 million of the appropriated funds have not yet been obligated, but they have been reserved for the projects noted there. Those projects have met the requirements to basically have the money reserved for them, and they're now in the process of completing the final design work and getting ready to bid, and at that point then we'll make the award. Starting on page 4, the big spreadsheet table, that is the current MPCA project priority list, all the projects on the list listed in rank order, and our estimates of what kind of funding those projects would qualify for. And if you just I'll just go across the columns to kind of familiarize yourself with the table. There's the project name, the rank number, and the points based on PCA's priority system, brief description of the project. The next four columns then describe both the income of the community and the project, some characteristics of the project, how many households it's intended to serve, non-residential ERUs. ERU is just a unit of value to try to take non-residential users and put them into terms of a per unit household, what a per unit household that the wastewater that would be generated. Essential project component percentage is a percentage of how much of the project is for existing needs, and those are the only costs that are eligible for WIF funds are for the existing needs. So the project may have some growth needs built into it. Those costs would be funded through our state revolving fund loan, but not through the WIF program. You'll see then the estimated project cost, and we've broken down that project cost per ERU or essentially per household. And then you get into the funding columns. The first column is the estimated WIF loan for those projects that would qualify for a WIF loan, as Terry Kuhlman described earlier. Estimated WIF grant would be those projects that would qualify for a WIF grant to match grants provided by USDA Rural Development. The next column does show what we would estimate the rural development grant to be, and then finally estimated SRF and or rural development loan. You'll see the estimated cost there, and you'll note that a lot of the projects we would not qualify for WIF funds, and we just would expect that they'll be funded through our state revolving fund loan program. The far column then shows you the cumulative total as you go down the list in priority order. These estimates are based on information that we gathered from the communities themselves. We did a mailing this last fall and asked for updated project information. We've combined that information with other information we had on the projects or that rural development has provided to us. So we're confident the estimates are pretty good. They won't be exact. Things will change as these projects develop, but we're pretty confident in the estimates. And with that, I think I'll stop and ask if there are any questions.
Representative Gideon.
Thank you. I'm just full of questions this morning, aren't I, Mr. Chair?
We enjoy everyone.
Thank you. If we receive the funding that is proposed here by the governor, how far down on this list do projects get funded?
The governor's recommendation is $10 million, so if you go to the far right column and go down the list, $10 million covers the number 47, Knife River, Larsmont, and a little bit beyond. The next WIF-eligible project there would be Medelia.
Okay, so Knife River is okay, but South St. Paul and Medelia and Vermilion, and those won't get it this year.
Well, right, I would just point out with that, the South St. Paul, if you look across the funding column there, that one wouldn't qualify for WIF money anyway. That is just down there for SRF loan funds. So we showed all the projects on the priority list, even though a lot of them aren't eligible, just so you see the full list.
So then maybe I'm not quite understanding here. If we get the $10 million, you will be able to get down to the number 487. But you will be able to go beyond that in giving revolving loans for those who don't require the grants or loans from WIF. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Genius, yes, that's correct.
Then how far down on the list for those who don't require will we go?
If you turn to the next tab, which says wastewater priority list, this shows the full project priority list. Again, you'll see the same rank order as on the previous table with Appleton number one, Moorhead number two, and so forth. This list shows project cost, and then the column to the right of project cost shows funding source or 2004 IUP requested loan, and what you see there are the shaded projects that have been funded, or when there's a dollar amount there but not shaded, for instance, Moorhead, that's a loan they've applied. The project hasn't gotten to the point of funding yet, but we do have money to fund those projects. So if you kind of follow that list down, you'll see that there are projects that have requested to be on the IUP, that have projects ready to go, and that we have are eligible for funding, really all the way down the list, down to the last project on the IUP that you see there is actually La Center number 181, which has 50 points. This year our board authorized 50 points on the priority list as the cutoff for the fundable range on the intended use plan. So in other words, any project with 50 or more points on the list that came to us and said we're going to be ready to go to construction in 2004, any of those projects are eligible and will be funded. I should mention that we've tried to keep that funding cutoff as low as possible for the last several years. 50 points, I think, is where it's been a couple of years in a row. We're reaching a point where the demand for loans exceeds the funding capacity of the loan fund, and that cutoff will probably be raised in future years. We'll have to wait and see what kind of requests we get, and I don't know where that'll be, but it's likely that cutoff will go up.
Representative Guinness.
In other words, it's going to be it won't come down to 50 points. It may be 160 points or something like that.
Correct. So if you look at this list and look at some of the projects that didn't request money this year but are on there with, you know, between 50 and 100, some of those projects, it's possible if they come forward next year, we may not be able to offer loans to them. And a lot of ifs there, but that's what it would look like.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm grappling with understanding this. I've been here a few years, but the first time on this committee dealing with this sort of thing. I'm just trying to get it straight. Your budget request for WIF, according to the slide, was $10,200,000, and the governor proposed $10 million. So what was it in terms of the agency request that told you you could get as far as St. Paul South Highwood, but you didn't need to go to Medallia and Vermilion? I mean, what is it, what happens, why was your request for WIF the $10 million, what happens after that? Or maybe I don't understand how this all fits together, but
I'm going to turn that question over to Terry.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess Representative Dorn must have asked a softball question because Terry said he wouldn't know anything other than
you see the smile on his face?
Yeah.
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dorn, when we initially put in our request for funding, we requested $30 million in WIF. We've done that every year since the program's been around. And the governor's, I think Carlson was the first one that authorized it at $1 million, and Ventura later recommended $4 million, and then he vetoed it. But this year, we submit those requests starting and start those things like a couple weeks after the legislative session gets over with, and we put those requests in, and then late in the year we do a survey that, you know, we send out to all the communities on the needs list and ask them if they're ready to proceed and or want to proceed, and if so, provide us basic information so we could calculate the WIP eligible amount. But we always try to come in at, you know, what's like the top 50. That's always our goal, knock off the top 50 on the needs list that need grant funding. And you know, this year in negotiations with the governor's office, Department of Finance, you know, it started out as well, zero, the legislature will fund it anyway, and well, maybe $4 million, so at least you can go up there and talk about the program, and then $8 million. But then when we finished the analysis and here's the report, and they looked at it, and they, you know, $10 million came up because that's a, you know, it does take care of those top priorities. So that's kind of how the project or the funding amount came about. But we think it's a very good number, and the governor's real generous putting it in his budget. So.
Thank you for your question. Any other questions? Thank you. You want to proceed? You got 10 minutes left.
Okay. Well, what I'm going to do is turn the remainder of the time to Mark Schmidt with the Pollution Control Agency, who's going to talk about some proposed changes to the priority system that won't affect this priority list that you're currently looking at and considering this year's WIF funds. But for the future, we've been concerned about some of the things about the current priority list, particularly in light of the fact that on the state revolving fund loan program, we are getting to a point where we're not going to be able to fund as far down the list. We're concerned that there's some basic infrastructure maintenance projects that currently fall fairly low on the list simply because of the way the criteria were drawn 10 or 12 years ago when it wasn't as big of a concern. And so we raised some of those concerns to the Pollution Control Agency, and they've been looking at some changes along with us at their priority system.
Welcome to the committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Mark Schmidt. I am with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I'm a supervisor in the agency's wastewater unit. And so far, during the testimony you've heard, and some of which you've seen today, we've talked about this priority ranking system. I want to just briefly go over with you what our plans are for amending that system. First, by way of background, the current scoring system, which is Minnesota Rules Chapter 7077, was created in the 80s for the express purpose of scoring and ranking proposed wastewater projects for funding. Now, obviously, with money being in short supply, it's very important that we have a fair and impartial system through which we evaluate all projects on an equal footing to make sure that the ones that have the most, the highest merit are funded. This rule has not undergone significant revision for about a decade, and although we are not really receiving any pressure from external parties to change the rule, you know, our opinion and the opinion of some other folks is that gradually over time it's begin to reflect less and less the changing world of wastewater need as we see it. And with the importance of funding and proper prioritization being what it is, we simply don't feel very good about having a priority list and a scoring system that doesn't reflect our most current thinking in the matter. So first of all, let's go briefly just through the process that we started and we're continuing to embark upon as we seek to amend this rule. Beginning in the autumn of 2002, we started to have some stakeholder meetings throughout the state of Minnesota to discuss with people what some of our thoughts were and to hear what they had to say. We also invited some folks into our offices in St. Paul, what we would refer to perhaps as key constituencies, to hear their opinions. We combined the information we received from that stakeholder outreach program that we embarked upon into a legislative report that we provided early in 2003. To the best of our knowledge, it was reasonably well received by the legislature. We didn't receive any comments to the contrary. And just this past month, we published in the State Register a notice of our intent to go forward with these rules and to formally solicit even further comments. The draft rule and our statement of need and reasonableness about the rules are currently being drafted. Once they're written, we will hold additional public meetings this summer to discuss, something beyond the conceptual framework that we've presented so far. And our target date for completion of the rule is late in 2004. So with that, let me talk to you about what some of the proposed changes are associated with this rule amendment. First of all, and very much in line with some of the discussion that went on previously with Representative Wagenius, we need to provide additional consideration for preserving our existing wastewater infrastructure. It seems fundamentally unsound of us to embark upon an ambitious scheme of building new wastewater treatment plants when we've already invested a considerable amount in our existing infrastructure, and many of those facilities are at or near their life expectancy. So our new system will, or we're proposing to contain provisions to reflect that need. We also want to address facilities that are near or at or perhaps even beyond their capacity. Some of those folks are on the agency's significant non-complying list, and some of them are actually under a sewer moratorium, and we believe those facilities require some additional consideration as well. As you know, the agency also has a very ambitious plan for impaired waters. We also believe that in the context of this program, there has to be consideration for facilities that discharge into impaired waters. So we're proposing additional points to be awarded to those projects that do discharge into impaired waters. There are other improvements as well. We also want to discourage new discharges into the state's highest quality waters or impaired waters. The current system also pays very minimal attention to stormwater related projects, and as you know, that can be a fairly important source of surface water contamination. We are proposing to amend the current system so that it provides some additional consideration for stormwater projects. We don't believe that those projects will ascend to the top of the list, but we believe they deserve more consideration than they're currently receiving. We also want to dramatically simplify the current scoring system. Right now, I think it can be fairly defined as rather arcane. It contains dozens of provisions in it, some of which are not very easily understood by folks that aren't intimately associated with the program. We're going to scale it back down to a minimum number of criteria we think are necessary to meet the need and to establish a fair system. And we think that'll help folks who are trying to work within the system understand why we score projects the way we do, so that they'll fear that their projects are being treated fairly. We also have some things that we want to do in the rule that actually emphasize some provisions that are currently in place. And primary is we want to make sure that the projects that address significant and environmental public health risks will remain the highest priority. Nothing we're going to do or nothing we're proposing to do in our system is going to change that whatsoever. That's what the program is for. We want to make sure that that remains the primary emphasis. And the second thing we want to do is we want to make sure that the project proposers that provide applications to us clearly identify what the demonstrated wastewater need is for their projects. Historically, we've had some difficulty having folks really define what the demonstrated needs is. For example, you may have a residential area with 200 houses, and maybe a dozen or so of them have failing ISTSs. It seems like automatically there may be a jump to let's construct a wastewater treatment plant for the town, when in reality, for considerably less money, those septic tanks might be replaced, and that really is only the actual demonstrated need for that community. So we want to make sure that the projects we get really clearly identify what the true identified wastewater need is, and not something else. With money being in short supply, we have to make sure that we spend our money only to meet wastewater need and not address other considerations. So as I said, we're continuing to take comments on this. We're embarking upon a formal rulemaking process very shortly. So now is the time for people to express their concerns or reservations about how the system would work, and we're all ears.
Thank you very much. Do you have a question, Representative Gaines?
I'm just trying to figure out in your proposed rule changes who benefits and who goes clear to the top of the list. And it seems to me that the folks who will benefit will be the metro area, and the folks who will fall further behind are the very folks that I see on this WIFT eligibility list after, you know, Medalia, Vermilion, this very small areas. So that's the way. Would you agree that that's going to be one of the impacts?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Genius, I couldn't disagree with you more. That is not at all what's going to happen here. As I said, projects that address significant environmental and public health needs will remain the highest priorities. Small towns that have septic tanks that are leaking and do cause those imminent public health kinds of threats, those are going to remain very near the top of the list.
Representative Gaines.
Okay. But the PCA's responsibility is not just imminent public health threat. It is protecting the groundwater.
Mm-hmm.
So just protecting groundwater in general. So I still think the way you have said sewer systems that are large and, you know, getting ready to end their useful life, which is, I understand what our previous testifier said, would get a priority. I mean, and those large ones getting near the end of their useful life seem to me to be more in the metro area, but I'm wrong about this.
If I could answer that, Mr. Chair and Representative Lagunias, there are an awful lot of small communities in Minnesota that have big municipal wastewater treatment systems, and a lot of those were put in quite some time ago, some under the old federal grants program and some even before that. So in terms of looking at the priority system and how those projects to maintain existing infrastructure, there will be there's an awful lot of small communities throughout the state that will benefit from looking at that. I think the projects, if you want to look at sort of the flip side, who's going to get potentially lower on the list because of this, I think as Mark said about making sure there's a clearly identified need and then looking at what's the lowest cost or most cost-effective way of dealing with that need, right now we've tended to see a trend over the past few years where an area that has some failing septic systems and maybe some issues with lake degradation or other water pollution because of those failing septics, kind of the way the priority system works, you can kind of draw a large circle around a fairly large area, and a lot of times we see proposals to come in with some pretty expensive projects to basically create a municipal sewer system in townships or lake areas or other areas where the density is very low, and it becomes really expensive to treat wastewater that way, not to mention the fact that there may be a lot of households in that area that have septic systems that are working just fine. And so the attempt here is to try to be more focused on where are the specific real problem failing septic systems and try to come up with projects that either just replace those septics or maybe look at some cluster drain fields or some other things that would be smaller in scope and lower cost than the real large municipal systems.
We have three members that have questions, and our time is up. If there are questions that are important to be asked in this forum, that's fine. Otherwise, I'm sure these people would be glad to come to your offices and discuss your concerns with you. And I think with that, unfortunately, we're going to have to adjourn this meeting. Thank you very much. It's been a very informative meeting. I appreciate all the questions, and I appreciate all the input. Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.